The following Dharma encounter with Jeffrey Shug and Arnold Roshi took place at Zen Mountain Monastery at the conclusion to a week-long meditation session. As you'll hear, Dharma encounters begin with the introduction of a topic related to Zen practice and training. Students then volunteer to present their understanding of the topic or a question for the Dharma encounter teacher to reflect on. The presence of fellow students means that anyone in attendance can benefit from the exchange. We hope you enjoy.
Good morning, everybody. So this morning we'll be doing Dharma Encounter. So during Ango, at the conclusion of each month's session, instead of a Teisho, we do Dharma Encounter. And this is a part of our training. It's a part of our own tradition that takes a particular form, which is what we're doing this morning. And it really is part of the ancient practice of the teacher and student meeting and engaging in the Dharma to bring the mind to illumination. And so throughout the history of Buddhism, beginning with the Buddha, there would be encounters, questions, responses, sometimes to present teachings in a way that were rational and conceptual and understandable in that way, and sometimes more direct in a way that was not so much speaking directly to the mind, but more to the heart, to the deeper part of our consciousness. And so this is a way of bringing that out in a formal way or a conscious way. Students, as part of training, an ongoing part of training, is that students meet with the teachers in face-to-face teaching, and that is direct to the student. It gives the teacher an opportunity to see where the student's practice is and how to help it develop. It's also a way of testing students' understanding, helping that to develop. It's done privately and confidentially, so no one ever knows what anybody else is doing, which is a good thing. It keeps us out of each other's business. Dharma Encounter is a time when we sort of borrow from that a little bit, but bring it out into the public. So it gives us a chance to really learn from each other and polish this jewel together. So what I wanted to bring up this morning is to really borrow from the couple of talks that I gave during the week. So those of you who are here for session will be a little bit more familiar with this. This was the Mountains and Rivers session, and I spoke about how from the very beginning Dada Roshi was drawn to this particular area when he was looking for a way to begin a place of practice. Because of his long-standing love for the mountains, he had spent many years in his earlier life in the Catskills, in the Adirondacks, canoeing and camping, and he had a great love for these mountains, and also through his study with Mizumi Roshi in Los Angeles, had encountered the Mountains and Rivers Sutra of Master Dogen's, which had been a very important encounter for him and remained important to him all through his life, and he brought that to us in his teaching, and it became really a part of our training. And so the Mountains and Rivers Order is coming directly from that. And all of the work that we've done both in terms of the Earth Initiative and environmental work and the what originally was a Born as the Earth training that we did in the beginning, where we started doing retreats out in the woods and in the rivers, was a way to bring us into this great earth in Dharma practice. And so this week I was drawing upon one of the fascicles of Master Dogen, not the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, but another teaching, Mountain Colors and Valley Sounds, and also from another koan in the 300 koan Shobogenzo, in which Dogen included this koan in the collection that he brought back from China, that is taking up a similar theme. So I just want to present back a couple of things that I brought out in those talks, and then we'll begin. And so once a student asked Master Changsha, how do you turn the mountains, rivers, and great earth and return to the self? And Changsha said, how do you turn the self and return to the mountains, rivers, and great earth? And so I spoke a little bit about how we so frequently can feel flummoxed by the world around us, people, situations, objects, events, things, the phenomenal world, the 84,000 myriad things. And so, and we can see so much difficulty and struggle in our encounters with others, whether they be animate or inanimate. And we also see similar struggles with our own others, our own internal objects, thoughts, emotions, sensations, memories, feelings, and so on. And so if we are to liberate ourselves from that suffering, which happens within those entanglements, we have to study how do we liberate ourselves and find our way back to the true self, which in a sense is what the questioner is asking. But Changsha is asking, in a sense, a more important question, or an equally important question, is how do we find our liberation within phenomena? How do we realize that the liberation of the self and liberation of phenomena are the same? And so that kind of thinking, how can I turn the mountains and rivers and the earth and return to the self, is part of the way that expresses itself is how can I turn or shift or change something out here to make this in here settled, peaceful, satisfying, whole, in harmony? How can I get people or my work or governments or other people's ideas to move in accord with what I know to be better, with what I know to be true, with what I believe to be necessary for me to find freedom? And Changsha is saying, how do you turn the self and return to the mountains, rivers, and great earth? Layman Dongpo, in the other talk I gave, was in the woods, in the mountains, practicing, and he was enlightened upon hearing the sound of the valley streams. And he wrote a poem. Valley sounds are the long, broad tongue of the Buddha. Mountain colors are no other than the unconditioned body. 84,000 verses are heard all through the night. What can I say about this at a future time? How could I speak of this? And Dogen says, the tongue of the Buddha, these 84,000 sutras, these teachings, heard all through the night, never take a break. They never stop. He says, the colors are beyond coming and going. And then he asks, are the sounds and colors intimate when they are apparent, or are they intimate when they are obscured? When our minds are cloudy, when we don't see things cloudy, when we don't see things clearly, the sounds and colors are obscured. We don't see them. We don't hear the sound of the valley stream. We don't see the mountain colors as the tongue and body of the Buddha. And so Dogen is saying, are they present? Are they manifest? When they are intimate, are they manifest when they are obscured? When we are intimate, when we are obscured, are they one whole expression or half an expression? When we experience something as distant, is that because it is only expressing half of itself? During previous springs and autumns, Dogen says, Dongpo had not seen or heard the mountains and rivers. He had been in the mountains before. He had been in that very same spot, hearing the same sounds, seeing the same colors. But he had not seen or heard them. Dogen says, but he saw and heard them for the first time that night. He turned the self and heard the valley sounds and saw the mountain colors. And then Dogen says, bodhisattvas who study the way, open your minds to mountains flowing and to streams not flowing. And so the questions are, how do we turn the self? What does that mean, to turn the self? And return to the mountains, the rivers, people, objects, situations, the world, life, in liberation. Another way of asking that or exploring that is, how do we not turn the self? Dogen says that Dongpo heard the valley sounds and saw the mountain colors, but it wasn't with his eyes and ears that he experienced them. How did he experience them? And of course, here we're not concerned about Dongpo. We're concerned about you and me, about this life here. How do we hear them? How do we see them? If it's not with our eyes and ears that we see and hear, then how are we to see and hear? Dogen also says, in this very moment of turning, I don't know, you have no expectations, and the Buddha eye, the eye of enlightenment, sees beyond seeing. He says, this experience is beyond the realm of human thinking. We cannot access it with human thought. So how do we access it? And what does that have to do? What does I don't know, having no expectations, the Buddha eye seeing beyond seeing, what does that have to do with turning the self, with realizing peace within conflict, liberation within bondage, clarity within cloudiness? How do we awaken the body and mind? How do we live in this world and realize it is unified? In the Faith Mind, I quoted earlier the poem in which she says, in suchness, in that moment of turning, there is neither self, nor is there other than self. To come into harmony with this, just say not to. For here, nothing is separate and nothing is excluded. And so in that moment, there is neither self, we're free of the self, but neither is there other than self. And so this makes it clear why Dogen says this experience is beyond the realm of human thinking. Right. So let's look at that. What is turning the self and returning to the mountains, rivers, and great earth? The Buddha said, from the very beginning, we are all ready, Buddha nature. Possessing Buddha nature, we're already Buddhas. All things already abide within their own Dharma state. The great way is perfect like vast space. Nothing is in excess or lacking. And yet we chanted this morning, if we do not realize the way, we are mountains and rivers away from it. So which is true? And as a little bonus, for extra credit, which you'll never see, actually, you'll never receive it. Dogen says, if you advance the self and try and realize the mountains, rivers, and the great earth, that's delusion. But if the mountains and rivers and the great earth advance to realize the self, that's enlightenment. So is that contradicting turning the self and returning to the mountains, rivers, and great earth? So how do you understand this? And again, you know, what's important to understand, now, of course, this Dogen is speaking poetically, which was his great power, to speak the Dharma through this very creative, imaginative, boundary-breaking use of language. And poetry, right, which is a very important part of our body of teachings. And a very important part of our tradition, and for a very important reason. It's not just cultural, and it's not just aesthetic. It's because this language has a way of communicating something that becomes like a bridge for what Dogen is speaking of when he says, this is beyond the realm of human thinking. So we're using a human convention within the realm of human thinking to bring us beyond. And so it means we have to enter into that language, right, without tethers. And so let's look at that. How do you understand this? Because what I started out to say and meandered was that all of this is about your life, every single speck of it. That's really important to remember, that sometimes with difficult language, when the Dharma is being presented in a way that just seems difficult to understand, and it's even though it's trying to explain it to you, as well as when the language is breaking the bounds, and therefore it's difficult to understand, that the purpose of that is not just to be a challenge, you know, of language. It's to liberate us. Everything we do is always in service to practice and realization. And so when we don't understand how this relates to our lives, that's just where we need to turn. We need to dig in right there. And so let's look at that this morning. Yosha, the chief disciple, will begin, and she'll start with three bows. And then those of you who are participating in the Ango formally, please come up and we'll form a line. And it's good to have a cross-section of monastics, seniors, students, people who aren't formally students, just so we have a sort of a representation of the Sangha. And so, and those who are doing this for the first time. So those who are, so just give an equal shot for folks who want to come on. So Yosha will begin.
Shosanshi. So I was thinking about what you were saying in terms of my life. And been kind of through a difficult time over the last several years with my work. I took a job about 2.5 years ago, and it was... I found myself in a very difficult situation, facing sexism and different forms of unkindness. And I really wanted to just leave and get out of there. And there wasn't anything else available, so that wasn't an option. And I really needed to just figure out how to stay there like I would be there for the rest of my life. And so part of the process was really seeing the people that I was having trouble with as not to, you know.
And how? What does that mean?
Well, knowing that they had good intentions. Their intentions for being there were good, and they weren't skillful, but they actually did have good intentions underneath the unskillfulness. So that is part of it, but not to at a much, much deeper level, that, you know, we are all products of our conditioning and of karma that, you know, we may or may not be in control of, and so we're all acting out of that.
You know, one way of of taking that not to and trying to bring it into a situation like that is a practice that comes down to us, which is conceptual, but it helps us to find a way in. And so to see someone who is acting in a way that is, you say, unkind or unskillful, and creating some problems, and to recognize that there, that in that there is some degree of unhappiness, of suffering, of constraint, of, you know, things are not moving freely, And that experience, when you have that experience, and what that feels like to you, is not that different from how they must be experiencing it. In the same way that you, when you find relief from that, right, they too feel similarly. And so that's a way of, because in that, in the two mind state, right, us and them, you know, we sort of disendow people of characteristics that we have or experiences that we have. We don't see those. And so it's a way of consciously, conceptually bringing yourself back into recognizing that shared humanity, which even though it's conceptual, helps to sort of bridge that gap a little bit because you touch their humanity and it can help to see past just the behavior and see that there's more going on. Even if you don't know the details, you're seeing the evidence of it.
Yeah, pretty much every time somebody is acting out in a way that is disharmonious, it's from a place of suffering.
Mm-hmm. And who are you talking about?
I'm talking about myself and anybody who, you know, is acting in a way that's not harmonious and not conscious of others.
Yes. Okay. May your life go well.
Thank you for teaching.
So Sanchi, so we've been talking about my moving to the West Coast.
Your defection.
I think you're playing both sides of this. One minute you want me to go, the other.
Well, it's good that you've come out. And
another minute you want me to. You know, one of the things is it's really gorgeous there. Shinko was there. Her parents. We have these great friends. And like, it's sunny. And I love being outside. And it doesn't get that cold in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that struck me a lot, the homelessness, I don't know if when you've visited your brother there, it's pretty stark.
Mm-hmm.
And at first walking through downtown LA, when I first saw it, I didn't quite know what to make of it. I mean, I knew it wasn't good. But doing some more research on it and then walking around it again, and the juxtaposition of being around people, being around friends who hadn't fallen into that mm-hmm. life for whatever reason, luck, whatever. But it feels slight. It's not slightly. It feels very odd sometimes to be living there and to be living in really a lot of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Things that I can't quite imagine, and then knowing that that's mm-hmm. literally either right next to you.
Mm-hmm. And so, how do you relate this to?
I relate this to this because I relate it to, I feel triplicitous inside. I feel like in one way I'm enjoying the very means, the very production, the very mechanism that mm-hmm. chewed them up and mm-hmm. spat them out the other end. Mm-hmm. And somehow right now I'm not in that particular place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yet, they can't be separate from me. Mm-hmm. So what I'm enjoying and what my friends are enjoying is directly related. And the two things couldn't have risen up without each other.
Exactly. I mean, in an unequitable society,
yeah.
those advantages are built on the disadvantages. Those gifts, those benefits are built on the thefts from others.
Yeah.
And so even if you're trying to not actively be the thief.
Yeah.
And so So when you're standing and looking at the mountain, right, it's over there. How do I get it to return? How do I get that distance to close? So how do you, when you see, you know, having been practicing all the years, having taken vows to live your life as a bodhisattva, and you see within yourself, so there's that mountain within you, and then you see yourself not acting out of that, right? You're standing over here, looking over here at another part of yourself. So whether it's all inside or it's outside, how do you, that gap, you know, the faith mind says, make the slightest distinction, heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. Heaven and earth are one from the beginning. How can they become two? How is you, how does you and the mountain become two? How do you and someone suffering that you're looking at become two? Where does that happen?
Somehow I've made them other, or I've made myself not be with them.
Well, I mean, being with is two, closer together, but the intimacy that Dogen speaks of, right? That where is that intimacy? Where is it realized? Out here?
No.
Where is the separation? Where is the separation created?
In thinking that I'm better than they, or they are not as good as I am?
In thinking. I mean, basically in the mind. There is no separation outside of the mind. And so when we really understand that and study that, we can see where, how the systems are built to create the inequity, right? And to justify them and so on. And we see those, all of those systems within ourselves. And so that's where the danger of the poetry is, that we walk away feeling self-satisfied, thinking, you know, we've got it all worked out.
Yeah.
But it's all, we're just thinking about beautiful things, right? Or abstract things. And so this is where it becomes very real. What does not to mean in that moment, in that state, in this state? Right? That's why I said yesterday, it's to realize the emptiness of the self. In a sense, the not to of the self. Takes a lot of sustained effort, but it's much, much easier than realizing the emptiness of all phenomenal things, right? Because they're out there. Yeah. They're objects. Yeah. Okay. They seem to have their own life forms. And when you talk about, you know, systems and policies and governments and nations and, you know, how do you practice not to when the division seems, you know, set in stone? So to look at that, to take that up and realize that everything that you're both seeing and trying to realize, quote unquote, within yourself is so that, and at the same time, so that we're doing exactly the same thing everywhere. Okay. May your life go well.
Thank you.
I should put you in touch with my sister-in-law, who is a CPA, works with the comptroller of LA, who's over the years has done a lot of work with the homeless.
Shoshan Shi. For me, it has taken a lifetime to experience heaven and earth as one. And it feels like a very, I can't even draw a circle, maybe that's why the Enso is open, like a returning. A returning to when everything through my senses is released.
Well, what is that turning of the self that Changsha speaks about that helped you to return to?
Could you say that again? I'm very nervous.
What is the turning Changsha said, turn the self and return to them, to the mountains and rivers, to heaven and earth being unified. What did you, how did you turn the self?
I offered. I sit in the rich Dharma field of the three treasures, of the precepts, of my vows, of prayer. I mean, I sit with so much to hold complexity, to hold.
Mm-hmm. So, and what's the giving?
What do you mean?
Well, you said you give, you offer.
Then I am. Mm-hmm. Then I.
And is that just happening there on your cushion?
No. No, not at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be BS. No, that's. Then what is my response? Mm-hmm. I mean, every day my heart is broken. I pause. Okay, now what?
Yeah. Yeah, I think if at least once a day our hearts are not broken, then we haven't gotten out of bed.
Right.
May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
So, Sanji, related to what Kaishu and you were speaking of, you know, when I hear language like the mountains and rivers and what they speak to us at this deep level, I want that. Mm. And I know that nourishment because that's what I turn to when, say, systems of family, systems that we've created failed me, or there were things that I couldn't, you know, that felt so powerful they would crush me.
Yeah.
And I love this earth, and I'm in love with this earth. And so where I struggle, where I'm stopped right now is when I hear that it's always back to what the way I must work on something as an individual, you know, this what we hear from the teachings that, you know, everything is perfect as it is, and it's my relationship to it and what I need to do to practice that, to realize that perfection. Mm. Because so much of, I think, the message that we receive in this culture, and I don't know, I don't even understand quite where it comes from, is it's you. Mm. That's the problem. Mm. on, you know, this, the individualism of our, you know, our system, our economy, that leads to this meritocracy that, you know, is so baked into the inequity of our systems. And so,
so-called meritocracy.
So-called, constructed for advantage of somebody. So again, it's me who has to do work. And I know, you know, from some of what you spoke of this week that, yes, when I'm sitting and I'm presented with something that takes me away out of that I'm turning away. Mm-hmm. There's practices and there are tools for me to return.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's so much in what you just said. you know, I think from the beginning, from my perspective, the Buddha was trying to disrupt this order, right, which has organized itself in a way that we call delusion or samsara, and that then expresses itself, mirrors that out in what we do. And so then we build worlds that match our inner world, which is exacerbated by the fact that we don't actually know this inner world. And so, but he wasn't, although he addressed it and he took shots at it in various ways, and he disrupted it in his own way, but he wasn't trying to tear down the system. And I think that, not that, that what we are being called to do as practitioners is, in a sense, what's been happening all since the beginning, is taking the Buddha's these very profound, radical, revolutionary teachings and practices and insights that base themselves in liberating the self, and then sort of keep demanding that the full implication of that be made real. It's sort of, I think of it in the same way that the full implications of the sort of our beginning vision as a country, which from the beginning was not for everybody,
right,
was not expressly for everybody, but the words, if you just take the words, right, there is a vision there. And that in the similar way, our mandate is to continue to live that to a fuller fruition, a fuller perfection, or a fuller truth. And so this essential part of realizing the world, because if we're just liberating the self, right, as Tose said, it's bullshit. And it's not, I mean, that's a little, it's not bullshit. It's real. But it's not come to full fruition, right? Because it's limited. And that realization becomes a stinginess.
Yeah.
And it becomes a selfishness in a certain kind of way. And so, and particularly within the Mahayana, this is our mandate as a bodhisattva. And in our time, in a sense, the landscape is present. The structures are actually present to be able to actually do that, right? For all kinds of reasons, economic, political, social, constitutional. And that makes it most, most challenging for us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's always been challenging. And I don't dare say that, you know, we are facing a greater challenge than before, but I think we are.
Great. Great news.
Yeah, we are the lucky ones.
Yeah, I find that when I turn and sort of look into all the world that we've created, I just hear pain at every every volume, you know, all along the spectrum.
You know, and I can't think but that's always been true. Yeah. We just know so much more of it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, for many of us, some of us, a lot of it has actually been pushed way out of sight.
Yeah.
So both of those are true, right? It's strange. We know so much more about the suffering of the world than people have ever known, and that's part of our burden. And so much of it we don't is become so abstract to us, you know, by design. Mm. And so it's it is not an answer. You know, our practice is not to provide an answer. Mm. It's a living becoming. And that is so much of what is hard to understand and appreciate, because we so want to just get to, like, be done with this. Let's just fix this.
Yeah.
And that will defeat us in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end. And so our resilience begins with realizing that is in the realm of human thinking. Mm-hmm. When you practice, you enter directly into that realm, which is beyond that, and you begin to realize what a path is. Mm-hmm. And that how to actually engage in an impossible task, right? And practice it as your imperative.
Thank you for your teaching.
Your life go well. And my imperative.
So Sanchi, I go back to the Buddha's earliest teachings, the Eightfold Path, and the 12 links. And in the Eightfold Path starts with right understanding, and the 12 links starts with the caveat, ignorance. And those two, I continue to look at, because the Buddha is saying right understanding. What is right understanding? What's the consequence of not having right understanding? not having right understanding creates this massive suffering.
And to understand rightly, we have to become very, we have to really study deeply that delusion, our delusion. We have to become very learned in all manner of ways about our own delusion. You know, we want to just like get smart, you know. We just want to have the understanding. When we study something, we just want to know that thing. And so, okay, the way we do that is by studying deeply, not understanding. Mm-hmm. The way we study enlightenment is by studying non-enlightenment. And up close.
Very close. The trigger for me is an idea happens, and I feel its solidity, and I feel its implications, mm-hmm. and I feel my actions, and I feel that I'm not in control. Mm-hmm. And so it's the making things mm-hmm. process that solidifies mm-hmm. that experience. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then you take that same process and replace a thought with a person, an action, mm-hmm. an object, a system.
Yeah.
And it's the same process, just writ large. And in a way, much more complex, because there's so many streams coming in. And so that's why it's so important to turn in and simplify the landscape, right? With just that thought, that sensation, right?
Oh, and without making things.
Right.
Yeah.
And then to carry that forward and see the same Eightfold Path, the same dependent origination taking place in concert. We're all doing it together, right?
Everything is.
Married life goal. You know, I have found that a very helpful way to not go crazy, crazier. one way is to study, you know, to really look deeply at these teachings, and then within my own practice, and really just see that wherever I look, that is, you know, maddening, is really the same thing, playing itself out in someone else or in a larger venue. And it helps to make it make sense of it. You know, it's still there. It's still, you know, it needs to be addressed. It's still a problem. But it doesn't just seem like just craziness. It's actually very rational. It's very methodical. You know, as Bodhidharma said, when we encounter challenges, don't be surprised, because it makes sense. And so from the enlightened vision, you know, we become less and less surprised by things. It doesn't mean that they don't hurt, that we're not distressed, but less surprised, because we understand how things work and how this action leads to certain consequences.
So, John C., I live in the woods. I'm fortunate enough to be able to live in a forest. And I can share beautiful things about being able to walk in that forest and let the self become transparent and fall away. And you can palpably feel that you're one part of existence looking at itself. You are that looking at its own face.
And what's turning in that moment? What's happening that allows you to have that sense of something that isn't there in another moment?
It's just a falling away. There's just like a resonance. There's a it'd be like saying, how do you recognize yourself when you look in a mirror? It's just there. But the thing is you mentioned just shortly ago the seduction of poetry and art. I mean, I think the thing is that I live in that world and I can feed from that. Mm. And as you know, in working with me, it has led me to be skeptical of the First Noble Truth and say, I don't know where you're seeing suffering, I see beauty. Mm-hmm. And as you know, this week, I knew suffering mm-hmm. because of the death of a friend. Mm-hmm. And that was a different falling away of mm-hmm. the self. Mm-hmm. It was painful.
And that death, the Buddha said, and we realize, is happening in every moment. And in every moment, there is a grasping. Beneath our consciousness, sometimes it arises and we see it. Essentially, everything we see in the world that is causing suffering is that very grasping. But it also happens in levels that we cannot see. Right? That's the important thing about studying the Four Noble Truths, is the Buddha realizes at such profound levels that we can't, it's very difficult to see in our ordinary ways of being. And so, but Zazen, the settling of your mind begins to open the door and we experience things in different ways, right? And so, so that, you know, the study of dukkha, it's important to appreciate this. Dukkha is not wrong. When the Buddha said life is dukkha, he didn't mean life is wrong, life is a mistake. Dukkha is just a way of describing the state of human existence within this consciousness. He's just reporting. Many aspects of dukkha are problematic, right? Yeah. But he's also, it's just, we should really understand this. It's just, it's a state that arises, right? Both through our activity, but also without choosing, because of how we're put together as human beings. So, and that's really important to appreciate. So we're not going to war against ourselves. And we're also not interpreting that as the Buddha basically saying the world is messed up, and that's you. You're messed up, right? You're doing something wrong, right? I mean, we may do things that are not so great, but life as dukkha is speaking about something at a very, very deep level. And that's why it's important to study it in so many different ways. May your life go well.
Thank you.
I think I'm too high up for the mic.
You're okay.
I wanted to first start by humbly asking what term I'm calling you.
Shosan Shi. Shosan is a Japanese term for Dharma encounter.
Okay.
Shi means teacher. Thank you for asking. So everyone.
Thank you for teaching. So Shanji. I want to ask about fearlessness in relation to returning, especially in relation to form, the form I'm in, the form that all of us embody in our own way. I notice myself as a female navigating through space differently mm-hmm. every single day mm-hmm. With this air of protection mm-hmm. and inherently fear. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that forever. Mm-hmm. And I also think about the fact that while I'm sitting here in this body saying to myself, I've experienced all this pain because of my embodiment. There are so many other folks who have had worse circumstances mm-hmm. than I have. And yet, at the same time that I'm dwelling in my own like little sad cloud about my embodiment, I'm afraid to turn and look at like the pain that myself has caused to somebody else. Mm-hmm. I would love to be able to cultivate like some more gumption or like bravery in terms of saying, like, you know what, this is really going to hurt a mm-hmm. whole lot, but, like, mm-hmm. I need to do this. Mm-hmm.
Well, so think about just what's happened for you over the last couple of hours. That's how. There are moments of collapse or crush or fear or I can't or I don't see a way forward. And then both through your own power and sometimes with a little help from others, we take a step. And in that step, you're stepping into the answer of your question. It's a living question and it's a living answer. That's fearlessness. Right? These virtues of the enlightened nature, when they're being embodied, we don't know. We don't know. Either because we're more focused on what seems to be the lack of that. And we're seeing that, but we're not seeing how the medicine, so in the moment of fear, we're not seeing the fearlessness, which is actually allowing us to acknowledge the fear, to stay present to it, to express it. Sometimes as trembling, right? But to know that you're trembling and that's our courage, right? And then to keep going. And so, you know, that's just seems to be the way it is for a while, which makes it a little tough because it's hard to, you know, get the strength from seeing the courage when it's there, but rather just feel the lack of it. And so, but it's there. And so that's where the faith comes in and just trusting your own practice and so on. But I would also like to just pause for a moment and just ask all of us, and I'm speaking primarily of men in our world, in this sangha, in this room, to listen to and reflect on your words that you began with and to really take that in, right? That how have I helped give rise to that fear in you? Right, as myself as an individual, as part of a group that has dominant power, you know, because this work is my own, it's not your job, and yet I am helped greatly when I hear that voice, right, and I love you, I care about you, and I do not want for that to be what I am giving to you. And hearing that, you know, the view from within, this form, gives me a window, right? An important window. And I just want to, I don't know if I'm thanking you or just acknowledging you. Okay, may your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
I am thanking you.
Okay. Thank you, too. Shosanshi. When I'm at work, I'm out in the fresh air, surrounded by trees and flowers and birds, and I'm on my knees weeding a 200-foot row of beets. And it sounds perfect. I want to be at one with that element, mm-hmm. but at the same time, I just want the time to go by.
Mm-hmm. Because?
It's like I haven't entered that element, mm-hmm. so I'm not really in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is that just because you're distracted or thinking about other things, or is it because it's hard sometimes?
I mean, I'm mostly talking, it's hard sometimes, but I'm talking about when it's not that, and mm-hmm. I'm just in my own way.
Okay. Well, in a way, because you're right there with the elements, and that it's, you know, the task at hand is pretty straightforward. That both makes it, in a sense, creates a very clear field in which to enter, right? And so to really think of that as it's a mindfulness practice, right? It is your meditation practice. The breath is each pluck. And it can also be challenging because it's so plain, right? And that's where we can rely upon movement, activity, stimulation, change, interest to sort of cushion, if you will, fill in some of the gaps or seem to fill in the gaps of our lack of mindfulness, right? Because things keep being interested or keep changing. And so that's one of the virtues of Zazen, for instance, of laying everything so plain that you have to see, right? What's in front of you and how difficult it is to actually just sustain that awareness in one moment in such plain-like water landscapes. You know, sometimes people will say, it's hard for me to maintain my attention in my Zazen, but it's much easier when I'm doing like a movement. And it's like yes and no. Yes, you're finding it easier, but if you look, there's a reason why you're finding it more difficult in Zazen. It's because there's no movement. And so that's really showing us, in a sense, the more true state of our mindfulness, which we need to see, right? Because then that allows us to practice. So you might just think of it that way, right? That in that way, it's very clear. Because sometimes when it gets more complicated, it's hard to know, how do I be mindful in this when there's so many moving parts, right? And it's never actually unclear. It's always just, we're always somewhere. Right? Our hands are touching something. Our eyes are focused on in some direction. That's where our mindfulness needs to be. But we can get caught up in all of that. And so, in a sense, it's easier, but to sustain it, right, in such a plain landscape can be more challenging. But, you know, what it's like in Sesshin, what we see is in that plainness, things come alive. You know that? You know that experience?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's like I've been doing that for a while,
mm-hmm.
and it just feels like I'm just like skidding along on the surface, and mm-hmm. I'm not letting that happen.
Well, think about the same way, you know, many students say the exact same thing about what's happening in their Zazen. They're focused, they're not getting lost in thoughts, and yet there's something that seems to be holding them back from sort of letting go at a deeper level. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and also there's a you know, sometimes you'll see in the teachings where the teacher will say, you know, sit and sustain your attention, your mindfulness, your concentration, and then take a break. We call that kinhin. Right? Which is not really, I mean, it's shifting your attention into another form of meditation. And then you come back refreshed, right? Because we do find something challenging about sustaining that in the same direction, in the same form over an increasing period of time, right? So that's one of the reasons we do that, is it does stretch the legs. It also teaches us to move the meditation into activity. And it helps us to refresh ourselves so that when we sit down again, you know, you're refreshed. So I don't know if you can do that. You know, weed the beans for a while and then go do something else and come back and weed the beans. Sometimes we can't, right? And so we just have to work at developing ourselves in that one place. But, you know, this is where digging in and finding ways to bring more aliveness and constancy to your practice, you find it.
Thank you.
Shosanshi, when Yosha was talking about her work situation, you know, she said that the people who she was having conflict with, they had good intention.
Mm-hmm.
What about people who don't have good intention? You know, how do I not create too?
Yeah.
No.
It's a great question. You know, I realize because of what my life is and where I live, which is a bit of a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
By design,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, I saw myself over the years just more and more. I thought it was my compassion just blossoming. And I realized it was a kind of naivete, mm-hmm. you know, because it just seemed more and more like everybody I meet, you know, is really pretty good. You know? They're doing good work. They have good intentions. You know, they're really trying to change the world and change themselves. It's like, I think we're doing okay. So I know that's not altogether true.
Right.
And it's hard to admit, you know, it's almost like I find it hard to admit that there are people who just actually don't have good intentions.
Right.
They actually want to destroy.
Mm-hmm.
They don't give a shit
yeah.
about you and me.
Yeah. right.
Or there are people expressly and explicitly want to hurt.
Right.
You know, I just read about this Indian man who's Sikh in Texas, who was the first Sikh, I think, who also wore his turban in Texas and was just stopping somebody for a traffic violation. And I just thought of all that he must have done and gone through to get to that position. And he wanted to do that. He wanted to be a policeman. Mm-hmm. And he was walking away from the car, and the guy got out and shot him in the back of the head. And I don't know what was going on in that person's mind, but I just thought, could he just not tolerate the idea of someone who looked like this having power?
So how do you turn? How did you work with that?
Well, sometimes first I get angry.
Right.
And, I was reflecting on, and part of it is just my own projecting. I don't know what happened, really. I don't know either of these people. But the action is what's being reported. And so there's violence, there's hatred, there is definitely two. And, I've never wanted to kill someone, but I have felt hatred. I have felt anger. I have felt the desire to hurt someone, right? And I didn't necessarily know then, but now I know it's because I was in pain, mm-hmm. right? And maybe I felt like they had caused me pain, so I am going to hurt them back and more. And so I connect with that. You know, and it's sort of similar to what I was saying before about, someone else's pain. You know, if I stop long enough to reflect, I don't know their feeling, right? I'm not in their mind, right? So I need to be careful not to understand that practice is not knowing their mind, mm-hmm. not their karmic mind.
Okay.
But I can know their fundamental mind, right? Their Buddha mind. When you realize your Buddha mind, you've realized my Buddha mind. And in studying my karma, right, and everything that includes and necessitates, in very important ways, I am studying aspects of your karma and other people's karma that can help me to bridge that gap. How do you do it?
Well, in some ways... In a weird way, that actually makes it harder in some ways. You know, when I could just write people off as just like, just hate-filled abominations, mm-hmm. and then just that's it, mm-hmm. to the core, done, right? Mm-hmm. That was actually in some ways easier than right now, when I'm able to get in touch with, that potential,
yeah.
right? That it didn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way.
That's and actually, why? Why is that so hard?
It just fills me with just such sadness and regret that, like, this guy, that whatever the karmic stuff of his life, it led him to that moment where he pulled out a gun and shot that guy in the back of the head, right? No, I don't have to know what it was, but that's exactly what happened, right?
Yeah.
And
it's too painful.
Yeah, it's too painful. It didn't have to be.
Right.
Right. Something could have happened differently.
Yeah. I know. It's so... so painful, because it doesn't have to be that way.
Exactly.
Merit Lapkowal.
Thank you for your teaching.
In a funny kind of way, that is often not funny at all, practice makes things so much easier and so much harder. Because the things that we would have and did and sometimes still do shut out, turn away from, ignore, deny, become increasingly, that way, that path becomes increasingly not viable. And it can begin in just knowing that that's not the right path. It can be not wanting that to be the right path, or the path that we take. It can be because we've made a commitment to a truer path. But ultimately, it gets to the point where you just can't. You just can't. And so then you're just stuck with it. And so at every step along the way, and as each of those stages is unfolding, we are becoming that person. We are becoming that person who can, in a sense, take that in, step into that, that non-duality, that being, because those turnings are taking place in such a way that we are now have that capacity, not just inherently, because we all have it inherently, but actually here and now. And even though there are lots of times where we may feel like, no, I'm not actually up to that, because it's so hard to hold, you find a way. And we find a way in an increasingly wise and compassionate manner, in an increasingly greater capacity to do that. And what's interesting is that, as I said before, that when a lot of times we're tapping into those qualities, and they're manifesting, we don't see them. We don't recognize it. And while in a certain sense we can begin to recognize them over time, an element of that that's very important is letting go of the self in those actions. We don't need to know. We don't need to know that in this moment I am being courageous, right? That when we do know and we're encouraged that by that, in a sense we're encouraging ourself, which is okay, right? That helps. But as we go on, we need that less and less. And that's a good thing, right? Because then there's just courage. There's just meeting. There's just not to. And so, you know, I think of how when I think of what is required, what I feel like is required for us to be Dharma students, Dharma practitioners today, where we're seeing all of the expressions of dividing the world into pieces, right? The fact that we could so skillfully and consciously and methodically create the ruination of the only earth we have. And that now we're seeing that so vividly, so clearly. And so that is both our burden, but it's also the evidence of our imperative, right? And that, so then to become really Dharma practitioners, you know, I really feel like means to study the expounded Dharma that has come down to us, which has always been, in a sense, the central, if not sole, focus of study, that now we actually have to have a larger study. And in a sense, if we just study history, but actual history, not the history that we were taught, the history we weren't taught, if we just study that, I think we'll pretty much be studying everything we need to know. To really understand, to study the Dharma in our individual and larger community and understand, how did we get here? How did this all get put together? And understand the mind of that, individual and collective, which is so important to understand its healing, its turning. And so it just means a bit more study. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.